a status report on clinical ethics and hospital ethics committees. Where have we been? Where are we going? In this edition of the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. practicalbioethics.org. Our guests today, two individuals involved with developing hospital ethics committees and who work within that system today. MC Sullivan is Director of Ethics at Covenant Health Systems in Boston. She is a former staff person at the Center for Practical Bioethics and holds degrees in nursing and law, and she has a master's from Harvard in ethics. Meyer Christopher is the Kathleen Foley Chair in Pain and Palliative Care at the Center, a position she holds after serving as the founding executive of the Center from 1984 through 2011. Myra, let's start with you. The center back in the 80s did a great deal of work around an infrastructure for hospital ethics and hospital ethics committees. What were the hopes and the expectations then, and have they been met over the years as we're recording this in 2012?
Well, there had been a lot of discussion about ethics committees and the importance, the potential of ethics committees for 15 years prior to the center coming into existence. A lot of it had grown out of the Karen Ann Quinlan case, where in that in delivering that opinion, the judge said that when confronted with this kind of decision, someone who no longer had capacity to make decisions and the issue at stake was a life-sustaining treatment, that if, in fact, the family and the physician were in agreement and an ethics committee had reviewed that decision and had no reservations, that there was no need for court intervention or review. And that was a very attractive proposition to people in healthcare delivery. Really, what I think the impetus for all of this was, frankly, was the technology, and that there had been this explosion of biomedical capacity that enables us to sustain bodily function long after times when many people would have thought that person was really gone from us. I think the technology, I think the more and more oversight and regulation by law enforcement and the states themselves, and more and more concerns just about what this was going to all mean. A solution, a proposition, had been to start these committees that would bring multiple perspectives, various experience to the table, literally, so that when confronted with these terrible situations, that families, providers would have sort of a sounding board, a resource to come to vet their concerns, talk about these issues, and to seek counsel and recommendations.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the irony is that when the Quinlan case was handed down, people read it, and it was seemed like such a wise decision. And at the same time, people were saying, what's an ethics committee? Uh-huh. You know, any institution that has an ethics committee, they didn't exist at the time. But, you know, as those of us who work in ethics have learned, the first step is getting all the facts before you for a significant decision that needs to be made. And what these ethics committees were meant to do were to bring the people to the table, as Myra said, literally, who could provide facts about what was known about diagnosis or prognosis. More importantly, in some cases, facts known about what the patient's wishes would be. What were their values if they had never expressed wishes? So there was a wonderful methodology behind the idea of the ethics committees that came to be after Quinlan.
Now, you came to the center in the mid-90s, around 1995. Yes. What did you see then, and what did you observe at the time? And then comparing that now to someone in the trenches, literally, in the work you're doing in Boston.
What I saw was eye-opening and inspiring all at the same time. When I first arrived at the center in the mid-90s, I arrived as a newly minted lawyer who had had some experience doing ethics, but in that case, it was always in a classroom setting. I was an intensive care unit nurse, now with a great degree in ethics and heading off to law, but anybody who was, quote, doing ethics, which is the phrase that we used then and continue to use now, were doing, those people were doing ethics in a classroom. by teaching undergrads or, in rare occasions, medical students and nursing students about what were some of the ethical issues and how you might think about them. What I saw when I came to the center was that Myra and her colleagues at the center had begun to create and educate, in the setting in which these clinical issues arose, the appropriate clinical professionals who needed to know that doing ethics really meant being rigorous in their thinking and their analytical approach to problem solving. Up until what I saw at the center in the mid-90s, you would hear in clinical settings that doing ethics was, well, what do you think, and what do I think, and what do you feel? And it was really hoping to do the right thing, but no methodology to ascertain that you were doing the right thing. And more importantly, since doing ethics was generated around conflicted situations, there was no sense prior to what I saw at the center and its establishment of ethics committees who were trained to do ethical analysis, there was no sense that the decision-making process was a valid one, really.
So fair to say, I guess, that we got off to a good start.
Yes.
Probably have done a lot of good things since then,
yes.
But have the expectations been met? And that's a question for both of you, and maybe starting with you, MC.
Yeah, it's very interesting in my capacity now to be, for the first time, as kind of the headquarters-based ethicist for a system that includes acute care, long-term care settings, home and health hospice situations, you know, a fairly robust system. It's very interesting for me now to see that it is quite expected that most facilities would have an ethics committees, have an ethics committee. These ethics committees are well-trained. They meet on a regular basis. They receive frequent referrals from folks within their clinical settings. And increasingly, they are dealing with ethical issues as well with the business side of healthcare. So I see tremendous kind of accomplishment of the goals that we had in mind that were still kind of a twinkle in God's eye back in the early 90s and mid-90s. But what's very interesting to me is that it's kind of the same old, same old. Many of the issues that we were dealing with back in the late 80s, early 90s, around advanced directives, around termination of treatment, et cetera, are still tremendously troublesome today. And on one hand, it's reassuring because each of these decisions ought to be treated as something new. We ought to never go in with preconceived notions of what the resolution should be because so much of it is driven by patient values, by patient decisions as articulated to them or their substitute decision makers. On the other hand, I do think to myself, does anybody read the literature? Does anybody see these are the things that we need to consider? So I think we have a lot of work to do on one hand. On the other hand, it's not work to do. It's ongoing work. With every successive generation of patients, of consumers, of clinicians, we have the same work to do.
But, you know, Laurel, about a decade after the center had begun its work, even then, we would have responded to your question as to whether or not they've reached their potential by saying no, that they had not. And, in fact, the center had the opportunity to work with what's now called the Joint Commission. It was then the Joint Commission for the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations.
Very good. JACO, I think, was the,
it was, JACO,
kind of the acronym
JACO.
For it. Sure.
To create standards and patients' rights, which really is sort of a reflection of the earliest part of the ethics committee movement and organizational ethics. As MC said, ethics committees are beginning now, I think, to recognize more and more that decisions in healthcare are not just about the technology, what can we do? It is, they are not just about what does this patient what would their values be? What would this family want? There are serious questions now about what can we afford and what will the regulators and others allow us to do. So we began to, I believe that it was 1992 or 3, that I wrote a piece for Bioethics Forum, a publication of the center, that basically said that ethics committees had failed as they were then being thought up. And about a year later, Dr. Robert Potter and I began to work on a new model that we called an integrated ethics program, which was sort of a logical outgrowth of the work we had done with JCHO. So it was probably 94. As you know, MC is here today because we are doing some work inside of her system, working with her. And she brought to my attention a new resource guide that has been developed by the Catholic Health Association to help institutions to be sure that they preserve the traditional values and the ethics of the church and the systems that they represent. And I jokingly said to MC today, we're going to have to bring a lawsuit because they just plagiarized our work. I am thrilled to see. I mean, that is a joke. I am thrilled to see that this idea that we were noodling on really now 18 years ago is moving in to be the dominant model. I mean, healthcare changes slowly.
Right, right. I mean, one of the things that's so interesting to me now is that what was healthcare ethics is now clinical ethics. So we really see healthcare ethics. We see system and national system ethics in the way of healthcare delivery ethics. And we see healthcare policy ethics looking at the larger questions of healthcare reform and how effective is everything. And the same ethics committee that we trained to deal with clinical issues are now meant to really be cognizant of and aware of all these layers of the onion, you know, kind of peel away and say, what are we talking about here? What are the complexities that we need to consider?
So the scope of what a hospital ethics committee is asked to do is expanding. Are we reaching the point where we're asking too much of hospital ethics committees?
And
let me put that in a little more of a framework. I'm thinking of the state law in Texas where, if I recall correctly, the hospital ethics committees are essentially put in the position of saying yes or no to whether or not someone's care would continue in certain circumstances.
Your question is a really good one, and I agree with Myra that the answer to your question is no. What this kind of shifting sand or this changing context does is demand that those of us who are responsible for helping to educate and provide formation for ethics committees, that we do our job better and more comprehensively all the time. Because honestly, these are decisions that have to be made, and we want them to be made within the context that they occur. These problems, these issues, these topics, these disputes, these competing senses of duties and obligations, we don't want to remove them from the context or have people participating in the decision-making who don't understand the context in which the decision has to be implemented. And so who better to address these issues than an ethics committee, but a well-formed one, one that takes their obligations seriously to be informed and also has the full kind of credence and authority and backing of the organization for whom they
and
work.
And, Laurel, that Texas legislation, you know, it's not the only legislation. There's legislation in Florida around unbefriended people and so forth. But the Texas legislation originally emerged via the debate about medical futility. And when you have good people around an issue, around a decision regarding a person generally who can no longer decide for themselves, and there's disagreement, how do those things get decided? And so really you're kind of confronted with, do you go to the courts? And the courts have over and over and over again said, don't bring this stuff to us. We don't have any training around this. We don't have any context or experience. So as MC has said, we've always argued that the best decisions are the ones made closest to the bedside, meaning really closest to the goals and values of the individual about whom we're concerned and of those who are caring for that person. So although ethics committees, you know, we just pound it into their heads, you are not decision makers. You only make recommendations. Part of that was for political reasons, because we didn't want physicians and the traditional decision makers to be afraid that their authority would be usurped by ethics committees. Part of it was also for protection of those who were involved. If you're not making a decision, you're probably not likely to be sued for having been involved in this. But as things have progressed, we see many times when physicians, quite frankly, don't want the responsibility. And not just that they're timid or cowardly, the situations are so complex that they really want the moral support, the assistance, the engagement, collaboration of others to make these very difficult decisions.
Well, thus far we've been talking about the people on the ethics committee or the people on the medical side of the ethics committee. MC, you're involved with us now in your position in Boston. How about the people who come and seek the advice of an ethics committee, the families who are struggling with a family member, a loved one who is suffering through a particular kind of a situation, the general public, I guess. What's their understanding of a hospital ethics committee, and what are their expectations?
It's very interesting, and a lot of that depends upon the sophistication of the community that you're dealing with. And I don't mean sophistication in the kind of socioeconomic sense at all. I mean, what is their familiarity with healthcare generally? And then, you know, parsing it out, what their resources are within that healthcare organization or facility. So, for example, there are some institutions that, as part of the welcome to our hospital literature, will say, if there are issues that you are having trouble with or which you would like to get deeper resources available to you than just your immediate care team, we have this ethics committee. That's fantastic. That is fantastic. There are other people who have studied ethics and will ask about it. You know, increasing numbers of people are taking electives in bioethics as part of their undergrad education. And then there are also those communities where the ethics committee sees as part of their job public education, community outreach, you know, advocacy, in not in the sense of advocating for a specific position so much as advocacy around issues and healthcare problems. And so you see there's a tremendous amount of sophistication in the general public, and they will ask about it. There's another resource available to people, and those are the folks who have either been on an ethics committee or are on an ethics committee. They will tell patients and families who are wrestling with situations or who among themselves are at odds about what ought to happen either to themselves or their loved ones. And so they will recommend ethics committee. So we're seeing, you know, I think tremendous grounds in the access to and the use of and familiarity with ethics committees. There's a lot of work to do.
But, you know, Laurel, if you think about how much time has passed that we're talking about here, from the very earliest 70s to 2012 now, you know, the world has changed dramatically, but certainly the world of healthcare has changed amazingly. And I have thought about Bill Bartholomew, our colleague, while we've been talking today, who was very much a pioneer in the field of bioethics. And he used to say, you know, what we need to do here is we need to kind of quietly infect institutions with ethics. You know, we don't want ethics to be centralized in the context of these committees. We want everybody in the institution to be thinking about this. And I remember when we were initially talking to health system leaders and saying, you know, think with us about this bigger approach, not an ethics committee, but an integrated ethics program. A CEO of a very large health system out in the Southwest said to me, "My God, sounds to me like you want the housekeeper to be doing ethics around here."
Oh, my.
And I said, actually, I do. Because the reality is your housekeeper is spending more time with your patients than are your physicians. And sometimes very late at night when someone's there sweeping your floors or changing your bed, you might be at a place where you say, you know what, I don't know if I can do this anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think what we have seen, and in your comment, MC, that if you think about all the people who have been on ethics committees, you know, in a few weeks here, we're going to have our annual dinner, and there'll be 700 or 800 people in the room. And someone usually that night says, all of you who have ever served on an ethics committee, raise your hand or stand or do something. Well, when the center first started, there would have been no people standing.
Maybe
no
10 people raised. Out of 800.
Now, yeah. You know, it's probably three-fourths of the room has taken their turn. They have served on the ethics committee for a period of time. So I think Bartholomew's view, in a way, has come true, that we have kind of infiltrated our healthcare delivery systems by training people, by having these committees.
But, you know, I have heard people in the past, and you've heard me, MC, rail at them when they would say, as a member of the Ethics Committee, we are the conscience, the moral conscience of this organization. And I would think, oh, BS. If that's the best this institution has to offer, then I don't ever want to be here.
I just can't imagine you saying BS to anybody.
Can you imagine? I mean, because there are moral agents all through these systems. You have responsibilities.
Exactly. In the last, you know, typically as we keep talking about the Ethics Committee as this discrete entity, and most hospitals, in fact, do have people who are chairs. They are tucked either into the Department of Medicine or they are tucked into under the board. I mean, they're getting stature and status within the organization. And generally, you know, there's a certain amount of interdisciplinary membership. There are periods of time that you serve on and then rotate off the Ethics Committee. But I found the most extraordinary model a couple of years ago when for a period after I left the center, I was working on my own doing ethics consulting. And one institution that I consulted to was a small hospital system in the Northeast in the U.S. And one of the things that they did was appoint the co-chairs of the Ethics Committee, but there was no discrete committee. And once a month, they would have Ethics Committee meetings to which anybody on the hospital staff could attend. And when possible, it was announced what the topic was, or people were asked to submit a case for review. It was the most extraordinary thing, and I remember the first few times when I was asked to kind of go in when situations required formal explication or education. The reason I had been hired as the consult was to do that, give the background law or give the relevant ethical theory or kind of lift up principles that might help conduct the discussion. And I remember thinking the first one or two times that I went in, this is no way to run an airline. I just thought, this, you know, how effective is this going to be ultimately? Well, what I found out, and it goes to Bill's comment, it was tremendously effective because soon enough, the whole hospital community, from the kitchen to the environmental services to the parking lot attendant to the boardroom, had learned similar language. They had learned fundamental questions to ask when presented with a perplexing situation. And while it may not have been quite as schooled and formal as the folks who sat on an ethics committee and went through a kind of orientation to it and a training period for it, it was much more pervasive. It was much more inclusive. And ultimately, in my experience, and I only was there for less than a year, it had much more been integrated into the hardwire of the hospitals that made up this system.
A final question for both of you. Then I'm going to start with you on this MC. We've quietly infected hospital and other institutions with ethics, clinical ethics, by extension, hospital ethics committee. Where will this be in 5 years or 10 years?
Do you know, in some ways, I feel as though it will be right where it is now, with more people being better about it. So, for example, as I said a few moments ago, what I saw when I came to the center in the mid-90s was total revelation to me, and for me, a new experience. And yet here I am 14, 18 years later, and I'm seeing much of the same kind of things happening procedurally. But what I see is broader acceptance, more frequent referrals, inclusion in a way that I hadn't seen 18 years ago. I suspect that we're going to see more of that. I think that the need for ethics committees won't go away. I think that there's a certain kind of sexy glamour to ethics committees. People want to serve on ethics committees because there's a certain amount of drama to it. You know, the things that go before ethics committees are fascinating. Or they aren't there. If it's something that just goes along in the kind of almost routinized way in which we make decisions constantly, both as moral agents and as clinicians, those don't get referred to the Ethics Committee. What gets referred to the Ethics Committee are things that are both complex and mostly conflicted.
But, you know, I would answer that question a little bit differently, yeah. I think, maybe significantly differently. You know, we saw with the earliest iteration of ethics committees the challenges, really, of what we originally called multidisciplinary dialogue and discourse. Now we say interdisciplinary or interprofessional dialogue and discourse, because we train people in silos, we use different language
frankly, the professions are underpinned by different core values and goals, and that was not easy to have doctors and nurses and chaplains and social workers and community members, lay members in the community, engaged in meaningful discourse. With the emergence of accountable care organizations, you know, we were 18 years ago talking about integrated ethics programs. We're now seeing that really maturing. That is becoming the standard. When we think about institutions that have not historically worked collaboratively, whether it's the hospital and the home health agency and the rehab facility and community groups, it's going to be, instead of interprofessionally challenged, it's going to be interagency. So we're going to have to figure out how to have dialogue and engage in decision making, how we're going to develop processes when you've got all these different entities.
I think you're absolutely right about that, Myra, because I think you're right with the ACOs. The medical home shifts. And, you know, medical home might be a home health agency. It might be the person's home. It might be a primary care group practice setting. It will be determined by, you know, kind of the demographics of a geographic area and the health of that population, what the medical home looks like. But all the more, I do think that the reason hospital ethics committees will somewhat look the way they are today is because hospitals are increasingly not the primary focus of healthcare delivery. And so the nature of what you see being the people and the diseases that they now get admitted to hospital for, the length of stays, the non-surgical interventions, all of that are such that when we actually see something, a patient and it's the patient's problem, be in the hospital long enough to need a referral to the hospital ethics committee, which I think was your question, it's going to look like what we have today, because the vast amount of healthcare won't be happening in that hospital. When it is, it will necessarily almost be problematic and complex.
And with that, we'll have to bring it to a close. It looks like we're going to have a lot of work still ahead of us here. MC Sullivan is Director of Ethics at Covenant Health Systems in Boston. Myra Christopher is the Kathleen Foley Chair in Pain and Palliative Care at the Center for Practical Bioethics. I'm Laurel LeBou. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.